Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, the Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
David Kulchek's eighth book, Deadly California, is another tome of off-the-wall murders, accidents, and robberies gone wrong that have happened in California. With true crime tales from 1912 to 1964, occurring in the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, Northern and Southern California, and Sacramento. Stories such as When Sally Shot Harry, Double Murder on O Street, Keller and Sargent Liquor Store, and Corpus Delicti. The book that we're featuring this evening is Deadly California, Murders, Accidents, and Robberies Gone Wrong, with my special guests, crime historian and author, David Kulchek. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, David Kulchek.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Let's start off that the last interview we had was from your last book, Forgotten, California Murders, 1915 to 1968. Tell us about your past books involving California, and tell us a little bit about your background living in California.
Yeah, when I moved to California in 2002, my wife's from Sacramento, moved home for family reasons. I immediately got into the history of California. I was a history major at University of Wisconsin at Madison and left my studies to come to California. And I realized that all these books, especially about the more frontier days, were all written about the same people. And I thought, well, there's got to be more to this. And so I started researching criminals that you haven't read about before, or murderers especially. And that's how I came up with my first book, California Justice, Shootouts, Lynchings, and Assassinations. I inquired Quill Driver Books, and they said, yeah, sure, sounds good. And it just happened that way. So here we are, eight books later, and it's been good.
Now, let's get to this collection. You have had, this is Murders, Accidents, and Robberies Gone Wrong. You searched, again, in the introduction, we talked about these stories emanate from Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, Sacramento, your hometown in California, and also Northern and Southern California stories. So tell us just a little bit about the process of gathering these stories and sort of the criteria you had for putting this collection together.
Yeah, the stories are just ones that I come across because, you know, once you read like an Oakland Tribune from 1920, they'll tell you about everything that's happening all over the state. You know, the Sacramento Bee was another great paper of record, the Fresno Bee. So if it wasn't in those papers, it would at least have a little bit. So if read those papers, you could find out about a lot of crimes and things that happen in more out there parts of the state.
Now, let's talk about When Sally Shot Harry. This is May 11th, 1961. This is in Redwood City, San Mateo County. And a Harry Olive, you say, is an odd guy, average intelligence, good physique, wanted to be a police officer, and married a woman named Sally LeBlanc in 1954. Tell us about Sally and Harry's life and what happens one day in May 1961.
Well, Sally worked as a secretary at an insurance company, and Harry just took on menial jobs and took classes at community colleges. He was insecure, guys, about his situation. He used to just haul off and hit Sally like they were driving once on El Camino Real. And without warning or provocation, he just started beating her with one hand while steering the car. So, and he used to just backhand her across the face. She told him how to get someplace for directions, and he smacked her for not being lost. So Harry joined the Air Force and was stationed in Paris, and Sally came to visit him, and he wanted to do the Badger scheme, which is a scheme where a woman will pick up a guy at a bar. And they'll like pick out a target, you know, somebody who's there in a convention or something, or some big wig. And then the guy playing her husband or her husband comes in on them, and they blackmail him and get money out of him. So he wanted to do that with his wife while she was visiting him in Paris while he was in the Air Force. It's kind of an odd duck. So when he got out of the Air Force, he got friendly with the San Mateo Sheriff's Department and Redwood City Police Department, and he went undercover as an agent for the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department, and he posed as a beatnik marijuana user to entrap other Peninsula marijuana users and sellers. And the police department paid for a little house he had where it, you know, it was like the pot smoking party house and stuff.
Right.
And Harry grew like a goatee and kind of grew his hair out a bit and spoke in beatnik lingo. And he had orange fur covered shoes that he used to wear around. So he was noticeable. And so, yeah, he went and narked on all the people that he had made friends with and had smoked marijuana with. In April 1959, he snitched on two guys. One guy was just a janitor, and the other one was a 23-year-old laborer. And they found like 5 ounces of weed and 3 marijuana cigarettes in the guy's shirt pocket. And overall, he was responsible for 15 arrests. So whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But he was just basically getting casual marijuana users off the street. So, you know, he thought that that would be a lead into the police department, and did some little lectures and stuff at lunchtime, Rotary clubs and stuff, about his experience being the narc guy. But he kept on trying. He tried twice for the police examination and failed both times. And that's pretty much ended his chances of being a cop. He ended up being a swimming instructor in San Carlos, and the marriage fell apart and they separated. So OAF like crashed his car in another car, like put the driver of the other car in the hospital. And, you know, they didn't check to see if he was intoxicated or anything, but he was getting drunk a lot at that time. Sally rented a 3-bedroom or a 3-room apartment over a garage in a rear house at 21 Birch Street in Redwood City. And the house is still there. And so is the apartment there. Harry dropped in whenever he wanted, and Sally couldn't get rid of him. She did his laundry and fed him while he hit the local taverns and dated younger women. On May 10th, he called Sally about 10:30 at night, and he wanted to chat. And about an hour later, after Sally had gone to bed, he called again, and he was drunk and in a noisy bar room. He asked her to join her at a tavern. She said she wouldn't, and he threatened her, saying, "You better come or I'll come over and get you." So she was terrified she was going to get beat up again. Since she picked up his .38 caliber revolver that he had left at her place and sat in her darkened apartment waiting for Harry to show up. And Harry shows up right about midnight, let himself in. He had his own key, and he walked towards her menacingly, and she shot him when he was about 2 feet away. Shot him right in the middle of the chest. One hit his left arm, the other one got him right in the heart, and turned around and staggered 60 feet down this balcony, the stairways, and into the driveway where he fell down dead. So Sally called her close friend, the cop that helped Harry get into his informant work. And he came over first before the police or anybody showed up. She was booked in jail, open charge of murder. And her attorney said that he had never gotten so many requests to testify for a defendant, because people who knew the couple voluntarily requested to testify in her defense. Even Harry's parents visited Sally in jail. yeah, no one liked Harry. He's, you know, he'd slap his wife right in a bar, right in front of people and stuff. And, you know, he wasn't a very nice guy. Harry had this girlfriend named Amy Burke, who was the San Mateo Times described as a blonde and a real doll. And she's 19. She sobbed, told the detectives that, oh, I promised that they'd get a Mexican divorce and they'd get married. And they shared an apartment in San Francisco. So the trial begins on July 5th, and it's hot, like 100 degrees, and it's in the old courthouse, no air conditioning and stuff. And they just paraded a list of people who all testified to seeing Harry, you know, slap Sally around in front of people. And she talked about how he'd force her to take off her bra before they entered a bar. And that she was like, he had her flirt with guys and he would be a couple seats away in the bar and stuff. He got his kicks out of that for a guest for some reason. But yeah, she was terrified that he was going to beat her up. And they had the trial and she was found not guilty after a 9-day trial in 100 degree heat.
You write about that, how big this trial was and how sensational it was in terms of the salacious testimony of Sally, where she talked about, as you say, forcing her to take her bra off before she went into the bar and to flirt with men. And all these conversations about there was pornography found, there was naked photos found. So there was a vigorous cross-examination of Sally that she endured quite successfully. And then you write about the dramatic verdict, not guilty, and she collapses in the arms of her attorneys.
Yeah. And her parents, who had moved away right after she graduated from school, they moved to the East Coast and they were there and they let her out of the courthouse. The attorney had a press conference at his house with them and they asked her, the press asked her some questions before she was going to go leave to her parents' house in Massachusetts. But she just answered a few questions. That was it.
Incredible tale. Let's talk about another extraordinary tale. Keller and Sargent Liquor Store. This is December 23rd, 1953 in Long Beach, California. And very interesting character, Lynn Feaster, tough man who despised criminals. And he worked as a clerk at Keller and Sargent Liquor Store. And he was a World War I veteran. Tell us about Lynn Feaster and some of the things that he does to counter anybody trying to rob the liquor store.
Yeah, he was born in Missouri and moved to Long Beach in 1938, and he was 42. He had gotten divorced. He had a sister who lived in Long Beach, and he had a son, like in Phoenix or something. But he had no problem adjusting to life in California. He got a job at the Keller and Sargent Liquor Store in Long Beach. And he lived in an apartment just a couple of doors down from the store. So he's a nighttime clerk, and it was pretty dangerous jobs. It's like why I put these robberies gone wrong in this book, because it's just fascinating. The liquor store robberies that happened in the 1950s,
yes,
late 40s, early 60s, but just amazing. I don't know why anybody would do that for a living. I read about one story in San Francisco, and the place now is like a very nice for coffee shop. So Lynn Feaster, he's a nighttime clerk, and he kept a bunch of guns on him. He hid them under the counter, and he practiced shooting. He did rehearse scenarios of how you'd act when he'd get held up if he could grab the gun. So there's no record how many robberies Feaster had hindered over the last 6 years he worked at Keller and Sargent. But he had officially killed two would-be bandits, wounded a third, and brought about the arrest of five other people. So that's just crazy if you think about it, you know. Mm-hmm. What a job. You know, I was a process server for like 4 years, and it was this guy had a much, you know, scarier job.
Absolutely.
But on March 24th, 1948, this 21-year-old David Krueger and 19-year-old Donald Moore walked into the liquor store, told Feaster it was a stick-up. So Feaster pretended he was fainting. He grabbed a pistol from under the counter and shot Krueger in the chest. And the guy survived, but they were so young that they were sentenced to the California Youth Authority, and they did some time for that. On August 12, 1948, these two guys robbed Feaster of $140, and Feaster ran out and fired a shot from his pistol. And the guy went by and said, hey, the cops just drove by. So Feaster fired another shot in the air. Cops came back. He hopped into the police car and they found one of the robbers, Walter Gillen, and they arrested him at headquarters. He told the police he had never been arrested before. He was like terrified. So it was the first time he attempted a robbery. He sang like a canary, and the police broke up a robbery ring that was all over Los Angeles area. And five guys, they were all under 26 years old, were all arrested for the crimes for all those robberies. So on March 7th, 1949, James Phillips and Gail Hare went on a robbery spree. And Hare was an auto mechanic and fender guy. Phillips was a car salesman. They were both out of work and broke. They went and hit this one liquor store at about 10:30 and got $75 from them. About a half hour later, they showed up over at Keller and Sargent liquor store, intending to rob it. And they informed the 54-year-old Feaster that they were robbing the place. Feaster had a different idea. He pulled out his 38 caliber pistol and plugged Phillips in the heart, killing him instantly. Feaster put down Hare with a bullet to the throat, and he died later in the hospital. So, you know, he kind of enjoyed the notoriety he had, and he told the Long Beach Independent that he had been practicing for 6 months what to do in case he was a victim of thugs. I figured the holdup men would take all there is in the cash register and then beat or kill you if they figured you had hidden other money around the store. I'm just a working man who needs his job. I wish they would let me alone. So not long after that, a postcard arrived at the liquor store for Feaster, and it said, "You will be taken care of for what you have done." And it was signed Gail Pal. So the police checked it out. They couldn't figure it out. They couldn't trace it or anything like that. So that was one thing. So on December 23rd, 1953, Billy Morris and John Davis entered the liquor store about 11:30, and they tried to cash a forged check. Feaster wouldn't cash it, and Morris got angry, pulled his pistol. So Feaster was caught off guard, and he pleaded for his life on his knees. He was trying to grab a pistol that he had underneath the counter. He was doing his little routine. And a Morse guy shot him in the mouth with a .380. Bullet ended up bouncing around inside his skull. And about 15 minutes later, Feaster's body was discovered by a sailor who came in to buy cigarettes. You know, that's amazing, too, about these liquor stores. Were open until 2 in the morning, and kids would come in at, 11 o'clock at midnight and stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, things are open a lot. You know, I think it was, too, because air conditioning wasn't around a lot. And more people did things in the evenings.
Right.
Just like in Sacramento, I read about this guy who was shot in an ice cream parlor at 12:30 and on like a Tuesday, and it's like, and he was an attorney. He was like, 40 years old. It's like, I don't know, man. People stayed out more, I guess. But yeah, they found Feaster's body. There was a .38 lying by his head. And then he had a semi-automatic pistol in his pants pocket. He didn't have a chance to grab any of them. So it was a couple of years before the Long Beach detectives linked those guys to the murder. And they arrested Davis in Salt Lake City and Morris in Compton. He still lived in the same place. And at the trial, John Davis's 16-year-old son took the stand as a witness against his father. And he said the night of the murder, he waited in his father's automobiles. Davis and Morris went in a liquor store. And a few minutes came out of the store, and he told that his father drove Morris to his Compton home, and then they went to their trailer in Gardenia, their trailer. He overheard his father tell a woman who lived there that Morris had killed the clerk. The next day, they hooked up the trailer and moved to Redwood City, of all places, near San Francisco. So the jury found them guilty and sentenced them to die.
Yes.
And they appealed it. They gave him another trial, and in it, his son said that the court, the DA, made him say those things. And he said, "You told me to answer the questions, tell the truth. You and the other officers told me not to ask for death penalty. If you knew you were, I would have never testified." And he had told the judge that he couldn't think straight. And he was asked directly if he was with his father night of murder. And that if he overheard Davis said he shot his, that Davis said he more shot Feaster. And the youth replied no to both questions. And the judge dismissed the case. Those two guys were let free.
Yeah, very interesting legacy of all the incredible lives that were changed and all the people that were killed just at this little liquor store, like you say, open late.
And I think when I checked, I think that's one of the liquor stores that's still there. So, and it's, I think it's still a liquor store. I know a couple of them in the book are.
You talk about an incredible occupation as well. Even though he was a World War One vet, he was ready for these criminals, and you say he couldn't stand these criminals. And so, again, he almost gloated when he was able to kill a couple of these would-be robbers at his liquor store. And then the fate that he endured himself, where he was on his knees begging for his life. You write that he's trying to go for his pistol, likely, but he was not able to do that and was shot in the mouth and killed in that liquor store and left to die in a pool of blood.
Yeah, he was probably acting, you know, getting down his knees like, oh, don't do it. And he was ready to grab that gun and blast the guy.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And interesting, the behavior of the son that, again, was forced to testify against his father, the Crown, the district attorney assuring him that they wouldn't ask for the death penalty. And then in that first trial, certainly they did. And his father received the death penalty in the retrial as a result of the appeals. Then the son turned the tables on the district attorney that had lied to him.
Yeah.
Incredible. Let's use this, David, as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. There is no perfect diet, and it's impossible to get all the required nutrients you need from your diet, and so Ritual can help fill the gaps. Ritual has made a multivitamin that helps you focus on what's most important, filling those key nutrient gaps to support your overall foundational health. My wife Lisa and I decided to try Ritual Essential for Women 18+ and Ritual for Men 50+ after reading about the important research they undertook to develop their multivitamin in the first place. A clinically backed multivitamin for women 18+ with high quality and traceable key ingredients in clean, bioavailable forms. Ritual's Essential for Women 18+ is one of the few women's multis that's USP verified, meaning what's on the label is what's in the formula. It's also soy-free, gluten-free, vegan-friendly, and formulated without GMOs. Instead of striving for perfect health, aim for supporting foundational health. Great news, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18+ to your subscription today. Now, David, we are continuing with one of the extraordinary stories, this one called Corpus Delicti, and January 28th, 1926 in Sacramento. And this features a person named George Waters and his wife, Myrtle, and they're getting ready for work. She works as a kitchen maid and he is a porter. What happens that morning?
Well, it was a pretty bad morning. They were kind of arguing. She was angry at him for something. And George, who's a porter for the Southern Pacific Railroad, you know, which is a great job for especially African-American in 1926. And he picked up a .22 rifle and shot her in the bedroom in front of her 12-year-old daughter, Genevieve. Now, he had like three other kids. So, or two other kids. So, you know, it happened all, you know, in the morning. Everybody's getting ready for school and work and stuff. Her mother, like, bled out on the bed, and Waters, her father, ordered Genevieve to get a wash rag and a basin of water, and he cleaned off the blood and carried the body to a spare room. Then he sat down and had breakfast with his children, Genevieve, 8-year-old George, and 4-year-old Nadine. After breakfast, Waters grabbed a couple of sacks and some canvas from the backyard and went to the spare room. And Genevieve could hear him chopping and sawing her mother's body to pieces. And Waters told Genevieve that he would cut her throat if she told anyone or if she said anything if the police questioned her. Waters called up his wife's place of employment. It was a sanitarium, and spoke to her supervisor, who was concerned that she didn't show up for work. He said she was sick and probably would not come back to work. And he showed up at the sanitarium a couple of days later, collected her clothes and personal effects that she had at work. He also picked up her wages, and he said that they were all moving to San Diego. So the family left Sacramento on February 2nd, 1926 to live with Waters' mother in San Diego. And by May, Genevieve told her 19-year-old sister who had lived there about the murder, and Dorothy called the police. San Diego police ended up calling Sacramento because Waters' story didn't add up, and they sent the cops down there to pick him up and bring him to Sacramento. They found the rifle and several knives with traces of human blood on them. So Waters pleaded not guilty, and he said that the wife left the family, moved to San Diego, and they were all confident that, you know, he was lying. They called, like, people that were neighbors and things that came by and thought things were fishy and stuff, where she worked and things like that. Genevieve went up on the stand and told what she saw. She said that they were getting dressed. Now, the other children are asleep. She said Mama was dressed and she was just lacing his shoes. When Papa sat up on the bed, reached for his rifle, inserted a shell, and shot her in the chest. Genevieve told that her father carried her mother's body to the front room for several hours. She heard him chopping and sawing. Around 6 in the evening, from the kitchen window, she saw him carrying 2 heavy sacks outside. So she was questioned by the police 6 different times. And his attorney took advantage of, you know, inconsistencies and contradictions. And this is a 10-year-old kid up there, you know, talking about her mother's death in front of a bunch of people in court. You know, of course she was just a kid. So he got sentenced to death, and they went through the appeals system and stuff. And he had people say that they bumped into his wife on a streetcar in San Francisco or Los Angeles. Their claims were all dismissed. But his Waters sentence was commuted to life with no parole. And Governor Young, he wrote, "Never in the history of California has death penalty been imposed for a human being without the protection of a body of the victim, and that only twice before in this state has a verdict of guilty been rendered in such a case, and in both instances, the defendants were sentenced to life imprisonment." So he lucked out.
Absolutely. No body, usually no conviction, but in this particular case, there was a conviction.
Yeah, and being that he worked on the railroad and, you know, with all the viaducts and bridges and things, you know, it was an old Midwest mafia trick to drop bodies onto passing trains off bridges. Like, there's a train underneath the bridge, and you just dump them into, like, a gondola or something, and it's Portland's problem or Santa Fe's problem after that. You won't get noticed for thousands of miles.
Incredible. Let's talk about another extraordinary tale, double murder on O Street. And this is involving November 22nd, 1922 in Sacramento. Martin Sliskovich, a 20-year-old Slovenian immigrant, you say, who was a bully who liked to flash his gun. And he ran the Young American Cafe, and he roomed with his cousin, Marco Radman, at a house on O Street. Tell us the living arrangements on the house on O Street and a little bit more about Martin Sliskovich and what happens November 22nd, 1922.
Well, Marco and his wife, Jenny, she's 25. They had 3 kids and another cousin, 30-year-old John Sliskovich, lived there too. So Martin, there's something wrong with that guy, you know? He didn't know about boundaries or something. He wanted to have sex with his cousin's wife, Jenny, and she wouldn't have nothing to do with him. And she threatened to kick him out of the house if he didn't stop pursuing his affections. And so he got mad at the rejection. So about 5 p.m. on November 22nd, 1922, Martin entered the house and walked into the dining room where John Lukovich and Jenny sat at a table along with their 9-year-old daughter, Agnes. Marco was at work at the restaurant he ran. So approaching the cousins, he pulled out a small caliber semi-automatic pistol and fired 2 shots at Jenny. As she sank to the floor, John stood up to grab the gun, but Martin shot his cousin 3 times. He turned to Jenny's prostrate body and fired 1 more bullet into her. According to Agnes, he stood in the doorway of their home for 10 minutes, but that was probably an exaggeration by a little girl. He was picked up by a cab driven by his friend. He only rode a few blocks in the cab and he jumped out and he hid in the Yolo County side of the Sacramento River. You cross the Sacramento River, you're in a different county. You're in Yolo County in the city of West Sacramento, and then Davis is about 10 miles from there too. So he was hiding in the jungle of the river near the I Street Bridge until he could hop a freight train going to Oakland. So the police came and they were just idiots. They completely contaminated the crime scene. They allowed newspaper reporters into the house. And while the police were scratching their heads over the body of John Slukovich laying in the hallway, the reporters discovered the body of Jenny laying in the kitchen. Like, the cops didn't even go into the other room or to clear the house or anything. And a little 9-year-old kid, Agnes, was weeping over her mother's dead body. So the police were, they said that Radman home was the place where you can get a drink of Jackass brandy and relax with your fellow Slavs. And, you know, that was not uncommon during Prohibition with all ethnic groups. Police put pressure on Sacramento Slavic community. They raided the boarding houses owned by Slavs and interrogated suspected acquaintances of the killer. They wasted valuable resources tracking down the cab driver, knew nothing about what his friend was doing. So, you know, they had a big double funeral at St. Stephen's Catholic Church, and they were buried next to each other in the cemetery. So later on May 11th in 1923, Slukovich was discovered working in a restaurant in San Diego, and he confessed to his crime to San Diego detectives. They came, Sacramento cops came and picked him up and brought him back. And Slukovich said, "It's better to be dead than put in prison for the rest of my life and made to eat mush and beans and break rock." So Slukovich got his wish when he was sentenced to the gallows in Folsom Prison. And his last words were, "Goodbye, boys." And it took him 15 minutes to die. So they hung him in Folsom Prison.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You know, that's that whole area over there from that last story and this one has all been torn down and redeveloped like for the last 60 years. You know, there are no old buildings in that whole neighborhood, and it's blocks, maybe 10 blocks on O Street, which is on the side of the Capitol. But this guys were staking out in the rain this bakery, the Sutter Bakery, that was at 1720 L Street. And these guys came in, and woman who was partners with this guy, her name was Minna Hockley, and Max Corral was the owner and the baker. She shouted out to him. And again, this is like in the evening too. He shouted out to her, you know, there was a robber, and Corral was like, "Well, I'll get my gun too." And they grappled and broke away, fired two shots right into Corral. First bullet entered his back and passed clean through his body, and the second shot was in his heart. Killers ran off into the rainy night. And here again, it's a bakery and it's open at night. You know, it's just amazing how people were out and about so late in the old days. So, you know, people saw these guys loitering and stuff, and all they could see is that there were two guys in their late 20s. So the cops set up roadblocks, and they went into all the pool halls and cafes and dance halls and shook down all the usual suspects. That's kind of how they did things in Sacramento back then. This guy named Charles McGuire hopped into a Southern Pacific freight car, and there's this guy named Maynard Berry, who was a medical student from New York City, and he was bumming around the country being a hobo, like a lot of young people did during those times, like on their summer vacations to get experience, have fun, maybe work a little bit. They started chatting, and McGuire started bragging that he had pulled a hold up in Sacramento and had shot this guy when he put up a fight. So Barry got off a train in Colfax, which is about 40 miles east of Sacramento, like right on the Donner Pass, towards Donner Pass. So Barry got off and told the train dispatcher about McGuire, and they sent a message to the next stop and pulled him over in Gold Run, California, which is now it's like, it's just a rest stop on the way on 80. So, you know, they brought him back to Sacramento and stuff, and the guy denied that he was involved. But after a couple hours in interrogation room, they probably smacked him across the head with a phone book and a rubber hose and stuff. And he finally admitted that he fired the gun, but had no intentions on doing it. So he told about his partner, 23-year-old Jarrell Rodosky, and McGuire said that he met him in a pool hall only hours before the murder. And after a couple of drinks, they decided to go rob the bakery. They hung out in the rain, scouting out the situation for 10 minutes. And McGuire admitted pulling the trigger, killing an Austrian immigrant. And police said, instead of complying, he grabbed hold of him. And so he started calling me names and he fired twice. So McGuire's still talking. He said about how, you know, where they went after the crime and the partner is supposed to meet him at 11 o'clock the next morning. And he just didn't show up. So he went and hopped a freight train. So, yeah, McGuire talked about, you know, he was on the train with him and he was scared that he would get shot by the guy and stuff. So the Rotowski guy, a few days before the murder, he was caught riding in a stolen car, but he wasn't the driver and no one in the car knew it was stolen. So they charged Rotowski with vagrancy and he served a couple of days in jail and was told to leave. So he was captured March 21st, 1937 in Leadville, Colorado. And he pled not guilty and changed his plea to guilty, sentenced to life in prison. McGuire was executed on December 3rd, 1937. And he was the last prisoner executed in Folsom Prison.
I have one other story that I'd like you to tell, at least we can discuss. And it's the very first story in your collection. And it was Papa Was Awfully Mad.
Yeah.
This is August 3rd, 1942 in San Francisco. And Rod and Gertrude Hake. And they're going to go out on August 2nd, 1942 with the brother-in-law, with their brother-in-law, Warren Ritchie. And in this particular case, very much reminded me of the story about Genevieve witnessing the horror of her mother being killed and then dismembered in the side room. This young girl named Janice is only 6 years old and gets to witness some horror of her own that August 3rd, 1942. Can you tell us a little bit about Rodney and Gertrude and what happens that night after they go out and he comes back early and she decides to stay out late?
Yeah, it was during wartime in San Francisco and things were just open 24 hours a day. And, you know, there was work to be had everywhere. Other shipyards were all booming. And Rod worked at a bulldozer operator on Treasure Island. Treasure Island is the island in the middle of the Bay Bridge. And there was a major seaplane base there, all kinds of things. Now it's kind of, there was a World's Fair there too. Now it's kind of like condos and stuff. So he was safe from military service because he's married and had a kid, had a job that had to do with, you know, military out there. So by 11 o'clock in the evening, they left 6-year-old Janice alone in the apartment in 81 9th Street, which is the dog patch area of San Francisco, pretty close to the stadium, the baseball stadium. They went out to paint the town red. And only after an hour, Rodney came home and he was really drunk. And Gertrude stayed out. And he was angry that she stayed out later. And Rodney laid down on the couch with one eye open. About 4 in the morning, Gertrude came home with her brother-in-law, Warren, and he jumped up immediately and attacked her. And Warren took off. He just got out of there, got in his car and took off. He started beating his 27-year-old wife senseless, tearing off her clothes and just beat her to a bleeding pulp. This is all right in front of his 6-year-old daughter, Janice. And the walls of the apartment were splattered in blood and just so was the clothes Rodney was wearing. The inspector cop, Frank Ahern, San Francisco PD, accepted Rodney's confession, took him to jail, and they got a statement from Janice who told the inspector, "Papa was awfully mad when Mama came home. He hit her, and I heard him say something about a knife. I ran into the kitchen and hid the big knives there so he wouldn't hurt Mama more." Janice had a bloody lip caused by her getting in the way while he was beating her mother to death, they called. So Rodney's father, Otto, is this rich farmer from Chowchilla, and he owned land like all over California, including in Oakland. In 1938, Rodney got arrested by Modesto police for selling some of his father's grain and keeping the proceeds. And he was angry that his father turned him in. I mean, he was basically probably thought he was getting a loan on what, right, you know, he was owed. Blurted out to the police that his father is responsible for the murder of his uncle 14 years earlier. allegedly his uncle taken carnal liberties with Otto's 14-year-old daughter, and this guy named Fred Green and Otto were arrested and lodged in the same place as Rodney. So this is like 4 years before he murdered his wife. Mm-hmm. So supposedly this guy named Carl Rasmussen, who was a ranch hand, shot or beat Collins to death in front of a bunkhouse. Green, who was 18 at the time, was working at the ranch and helped Otto and Rasmussen bury Collins. So they kind of said it was an honor slaying, and they just DA dropped the case. You know, the guy was a rich landowner, and it was kind of an honor murder, and they couldn't find the body, and they couldn't find the Otto guy, and so they just dropped the charges. So, you know, Rodney confessed to killing his wife, and so they sentenced him to 5 years of life in San Quentin. He pleaded guilty to second-degree murder. He was transferred to Chino, which is was a medium-security prison, in 1944, and then he was granted special parole on April 8th, 1944, and he enlisted in the U.S. Army just like a couple months later. In 1950, the census lists Rodney Hockey as a prisoner at the Madrid County Jail, and he died in 1963 at age 47.
It's very interesting, sort of what's written between the lines, that he was only sentenced to 5 years in San Quentin after pleading to second-degree murder, but he was also, when he was transferred in 1944, he was also given a special parole in 1944, and enlisted in the U.S. Army. From other stories, it sounds like that's you go to jail or you enlist in the Army, but this five-year sentence seems to be a somewhat of a nod in that where men were given sort of an understanding for a murder involving, again, jealousy and other men.
Yeah, it wasn't seemed as big of a crime as if it would have been two guys fighting in a parking lot of a bar or something. It was like, oh, it was just his wife. So. But it didn't sound like he had a very good life afterwards. And the poor daughter, she was just bounced around between her mother's family and his father's family. And I think she ended up in foster care. And she kind of fell off the map at about age 16. I couldn't find anything else about her.
It's incredible when you realize that this Genevieve, again, vigorous cross-examination is what they call it. And this other Janice is 6 years old, so even younger. And there is no way that the kind of trauma that is endured at a court trial can be undone, I think, in any doable way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's pretty hard to find any of these people afterwards. You don't, especially with women, they get married and change their names and things. And you know, it turns into a wild goose chase trying to figure out who is who.
Absolutely.
You know, some people just don't want to be found.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, though, that two small children in all of these stories that you just, you know, there was not a concerted effort to include two stories with children being witnesses to murder. But it is an unusual aspect of these incredible stories in this collection.
Yeah. Thank you.
I want to thank you so much, David, for coming on and talking about Deadly California, murders, accidents, and robberies gone wrong. For those people that might want to take a look at your other work, where would you advise them to go?
Well, I have an author page on Amazon. That'd be a good place to start. All my books are available on Amazon and in your local bookstore. I've seen them.
Thank you very much, David Kulchek, for coming on and talking about murders, accidents, and robberies gone wrong. Thank you so much for this interview. You have a great evening.
Thanks for having me.
Good night.